Whose land is this?
My land.
Well, 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 our war hero has arrived.
You made a good choice coming back here. Osage are the finest, wealthiest, and most beautiful people on God's earth. They outsmarted everybody.
They have the say. Who gets the oil?
Son, I got a question. You like women?
That's my weakness.
Well, we mix these families together, and that estate money flows the right direction. It'll come to us.
Shumikasi. That's how you are.
I don't know what you said, but it must have been Indian for handsome devil.
Why did you come here?
I work for my uncle.
You scared of him?
Oh, he's the nicest man in the world.
The Osage,
their time is over. We got to take back control of our home.
I was sent down from Washington, D.C. to see about these murders.
We have so many deaths, we've lost count.
It's just bad luck.
Seems more like an epidemic than bad luck to me.
Osage is dying by the enemy. Do not let them die alone.
Evil surrounds my heart.
You gotta pick a side.
I don't even know if you love me anymore.
Of course I love you.
Then kill these men who killed my family.
Did your wife say who she was most afraid of? Don't do something you're gonna regret for the rest of your life.
Got nothing but regret.
Hello everybody, and welcome to episode 107 of the Film 89 podcast. My name is Steve Amos, and today we were discussing one of the most eagerly awaited movies of the year. Joining me today are two gentlemen who have been frequent guests here at Film 89 Towers. First, someone who lives not too far from myself. He has joined us to dissect several films of the great Martin Scorsese, including Wolf of Wall Street, Casino, and of course Goodfellas. My fellow Welshman, Leighton Winston. How are you, Leighton?
Very good, Steve. Nice to see you again, or hear you again.
Yeah, hear you again. Our other guest host today comes all the way from the USA. He has joined us before to discuss Casino and Goodfellas, as well as The Godfather in episode 78, which incidentally also featured one Leighton Winston. It seems that the two of you are becoming our favourite double act. Welcome, filmmaker and cinephile extraordinaire, Mr. Kyle Reardon.
Hi, thank you for having me, Steve. I'm so glad to be back.
Well, it's good to have you today, because we've done some good stuff so far with the covering Martin Scorsese. And of course, today we'll be discussing Martin Scorsese's new film, based on the 2017 book by David Gran, The Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders, and The Birth of the FBI. It tells the story of a series of murders which plagued the Osage Nation in the 1920s. In 1894, large quantities of oil was discovered beneath the vast prairie owned by the tribe, and the Osage became the richest people in the world per capita. In 1921, the U.S. Congress passed a law requiring any Osage of half or more Indian ancestry to be appointed a guardian until proven competency. This led to many atrocities, many of which were not mentioned in the film, such as children were denied education and medicine because such things were not deemed legitimate costs. Scorsese's film focuses on one family. In 1918, Ernest Burkhart, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, returns from World War I to his rancher uncle, William King Hale, Robert De Niro, who lives on the reservation. King Hale likes to present himself as a supporter of the Osage, a benevolent overlord. However, he is actually one of the masterminds behind the schemes to steal the Osage wealth by any means necessary. When he finds out about Ernest's burgeoning romance with Molly, an Osage woman played by Lily Gladstone, he recognizes it as a means of which to transfer the land rights from Molly's extended family to himself and other white men. The film charts the romance between Ernest and Molly, Ernest's increasing involvement in the crime, and finally, the arrival of the FBI and the investigation into the murders. It's a searing indictment of racism, capitalism, and greed. So, guys, without going into any detail, because there's plenty of time to do that, what were your expectations going into the film?
I was super excited for the film, minus the runtime. When I saw 3 hours and 27 minutes, I was almost aggravated because it was like, all right, this is a film I'm going to have to fit into my schedule. And I felt the same way about Irishman when that came out. But the subject matter of itself lends it to that runtime, or to a runtime of, you know, that length. And if anyone's capable of using that runtime to its advantage, it would be Martin Scorsese. So once I did find the time to go to the theater to see it, I was super excited. I thought it was a great marriage of subject matter and the director himself.
Mine were through the roof, truthfully. When the film was first announced, I actually went out and got the book that it was based on and devoured it within 2 or 3 days. Because it was such a compelling story. And of course, you start hearing that Scorsese's reuniting with DiCaprio. Bob De Niro's involved with it. Eric Roth is writing the script along with Martin Scorsese. Along with, I think, Oppenheimer, they possibly, and Dune, which is now being pushed to next year. They were the most three anticipated films I wanted to see this year.
Well, it's Scorsese in it, so that's obviously puts his hand up straight away, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah,
100%.
That as well.
Yeah. Well, I actually read the book before I had heard of the film. Because, well, I did read the book. I actually downloaded it on the Audible app. It was a fantastic, fascinating story. One that, you know, really generates outrage. Then I remember a couple of months later, I was sitting down in the office and my colleague and friend, Tony Sower, said that, you know, have you heard about the Martin Scorsese's new film? He's announced it. Killers of the Flower Moon. In fact, I don't think he had the name correct at the time. He said, you know, because it's an unusual name. And as soon as he said, I was like, oh, I've read that. That's brilliant. I have no idea how he's going to do it. That's fantastic. You know, because the book is very sprawling. It's, you know, it focuses mostly on the FBI. It covers a huge amount of information. But, you know, he did it with Gangs in New York, which is very similar. So, and after The Irishman, after everything else that he's done, and me being I've seen every Scorsese film in the cinema since Goodfellas, and there was no way I was going to miss this one.
I think the temptation, a lot like Irishman, was potentially to wait for it to come onto Apple TV. But yeah, I think because we would then see in the scope and the size of the production and how it looked, it demanded to be seen on the big screen. I think Paramount and Apple got wise to releasing it. I know Netflix and Amazon do these releases where they put them into the cinema for a short period. But I think they're a little bit more wise to this, that there's probably going to be a bigger expectation in it being in the cinema for a little bit longer until it does eventually come on Apple TV, which I don't think they've released the date yet, have they?
I don't think they will until they find out how much this and how long it's going to be in the cinema, because it's got at least a 45-day window.
Yeah.
And beyond that, you know, if it continues to pull in money, and it's made, I think it was about $23 million in its first weekend, which is not bad for a 3.5-hour historical epic.
It's going to have legs as well, isn't it? Because I think because of the reaction to the film, I think there's going to be people who go in and, much like ourselves, people who want to perhaps go and watch it again.
Yes, yeah. I'm hoping to see it again next week for half term. But I remember going to see The Irishman, myself and Tony. We had to travel all the way down to Cardiff to the Chapter Arts Centre to watch it, because it was in no cinemas around where we live at all.
Yeah.
And we had to make a big deal of it, you know, taking some time off, leaving work early, travelling all the way down in the rush hour traffic to see it. And it was definitely worth it. I love that movie. Mm. Luckily, this has got a much bigger release. And I think that Amazon have released films before and had a full release in the cinema before it comes. And sometimes you don't even know it's an Amazon film. They just release it, and then, you know, it's not until you sit down that you realise it's Amazon. But I don't like the Netflix idea of just giving it a very short window and then putting it straight onto streaming. I think this idea that Apple have got is a much, much better idea.
Definitely. Because Netflix do it just to sort of ensure that they can get into award season more than anything in that strategy, isn't there?
Yeah, and I think when Killers of the Flower Moon does come on streaming, it's probably going to be around Christmas or January time, which is, I think, is a very good strategic time, because that's when the Oscar votes start coming in and people will be able to see it again. You know?
Yeah.
And I think that could be a very good strategy. I don't know if that's something they are thinking about, but the timing seems just right, if you ask me.
If I was the guest, I think it's going to stick with its 45-day window and then probably be put onto the streaming right away after that. That's what I've read, and it would hit that mark of like being early December when it would come out. And I think Apple TV and Paramount are assuming that most of their audience is going to come from the streaming, just because you're asking a lot of an audience to come to the theater and sit in the theater for a runtime like that. But it's nice to see adult audiences going to the theater to see this film again. But I think most of the eyes that are going to be put onto this project will be from streaming. And it will probably be in a completely unconventional way of how the film is viewed, because it will be broken up into like sections for a lot of viewers, you know, because they're going to watch it at an hour chunk at a time, or, you know, or whatever it may be. So it's going to be interesting to see people's reception once it does come on to streaming.
I was just thinking as we were talking then, that we're assuming that it's going on to Apple, but Paramount have got their own streaming service as well, don't forget.
Yeah, Paramount are only handling the theatrical release, though.
Right.
You never know, perhaps in the future when, you know, it's tied down, perhaps the rights could
I think it probably will end up after, say, a year or something. They might probably, it was probably written into the contract, isn't it, that it'll have the streaming rights eventually.
Yeah. We can't go through the film like we normally do it with a film, especially classic film. We go through it scene by scene. We can't do that today. So what I thought we'd do is split into three parts, right? The first part is the romance. The second part being the plot, and the third part being the FBI investigation and the downfall. To start off with, then, the romance then, I mean, because the whole film hinges on the relationship between Molly, played by Lily Gladstone, and Ernest, Leonardo DiCaprio. She's Osage, he's white. It's that the attraction of them to coming together and then end up, you know, marrying and having children. Do you think that was convincingly portrayed?
I do personally. I think it's the better way to go into the story than originally intended, because I was listening to an interview with Scorsese, and he was saying that the original point of view of the film was supposed to be from the FBI, like the book's point of view for the most part. And when he was doing his research, he found Molly, and he found Ernest's character, and there wasn't a lot of information on Ernest, so he saw him as a vessel to bring the audience into this world and to really see what the process of the marriage and like the whole genocide of these people was, and like bringing you in personally into a relationship, and then you get to see the whole world and the whole, you know, kind of plight of what's going on through Ernest and Molly's eyes, I think is just the proper way of doing that, because it just makes it as personal as possible.
Yeah, it also takes away the any accusations of the old white savior trope, doesn't it?
Yes.
You know, the FBI coming in and saving the day, which has been done too many times, if you ask me.
Yeah, like Mississippi Burning, I just watched this year, and that is a huge issue of that film, where you barely get even a black point of view in that film, because it's just the filmmaker who made it, and it doesn't really serve that story well at all, in my opinion. But with this, you know, you get that juxtaposition of point of view where we do have the white man in this world, but he is in their world, and we're seeing it through the eyes of them.
Yeah, I largely agree with it. I think the initial attraction, and Lily Gladstone seems to carry so much with doing so little, and the way that the romance develops between her and DiCaprio's Ernest, it's not immediate. It does take a little bit of time to develop on screen, but the way that the romance blossoms, and I think you can define a lot of it to that first image released from the film. That scene where he's actually invited into her home, isn't it, to have a meal?
Yes.
And he goes to close the window. She just says, no, you've got to let a storm pass. And he sits down and she just turns to him. She says, be quiet, or something similar to that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's so much stillness in that scene. But she just glances at him during the scene, and he looks at her. There's embers crackling, isn't there? And, you know, you can see something is connecting between the two of them. And yeah. I think it's particularly well sold. And I've got to be honest, going back to Lily Gladstone, I think she's absolutely terrific in this film. the amount of time you could spend just looking into her eyes. They seem to store so much that is going on. I think you said, Steve, didn't you, that the people are known for their quietness. It's not the case.
Yeah, there's a line early on when one of those conversations between De Niro, King, as he likes to be known, which tells you a lot about his character. And he's saying, look, the Osage, they don't say much, but they do listen. And he's saying it as a warning, be careful.
Yeah.
But it's also it sums up the characters. And that scene you were just talking about in the house with the storm, it also provides a bit of comedy as well, because he doesn't know how to be quiet.
No.
You know, and he really struggles with that.
You see the two different worlds just going against each other right there. It's such perfect writing and direction, just letting the visual and just the moment live. And I think that's a plus of the runtime, is like you get to live in these scenes. Like, it can just take its time. And like, you wouldn't be able to do that in a normal film per sense, you know, because it's like, I don't know. We sat there for 2.5 minutes just in silence, and like seeing Leo just fidget and struggle and deal with that just was so insightful to his character. And you usually won't get that if you're not allowed to play with the time in that way.
No, I also like the way that it was, the romance was, they weren't telling us about it. It was showing us, for example, the time when we realize that she's accepted him is when she buys him the hat. There's no words.
Yes.
All she says is, just put it on. And that's it.
Yeah.
But you realize that the romance is there then, that there is something between the two.
There's one thing I must say about DiCaprio throughout the film itself. I am absolutely fascinated how he's managed to, his face has gone into that shape that he's made it. Yeah. And that, I was querying whether he'd gone Brando-esque in The Godfather with like things in his mouth. Brando had those things fitted in his cheeks, didn't he?
Yeah, to make the jowls bigger.
Yeah.
And DiCaprio does something similar. No, but I can't tell whether he's doing it physically or whether it's just like a makeup.
I think it's physically. Like, because looking from, because the way he contorts his face in scenes, like, it doesn't look like there's a prosthetic. And if there is, it's an incredible effect.
You can't help but stare at his face because this is somebody who's been on screen for the last nearly 30 years, isn't it? Right? In very, very high profile. Well, he was in the biggest film of all time for the longest period. So his face is so recognisable. And as he's got older, yes, he's taken on age-appropriate roles, but yet he has retained boyish good looks, the bastard. But, you know, that way that he's contorted his face, and it's like a grimace, isn't it? It's like a permanent grimace. His face has changed.
Well, he looks like someone like from a photo of that era, like just someone that's lived a hard life, you know, that hasn't had the luxuries of like us in the modern world. So for him just to capture that in a look, it's incredible.
Yeah. And I think it's probably the effects of being in a world war, albeit that he said I was in the kitchens. And as King says, well, soldiers got to eat. So, you know, because he does have a stomach injury, doesn't he? That
We don't know why, though. We don't know what happened exactly.
No, given his easily influenced state, shall we say, he was probably dragged into something he perhaps shouldn't have been involved with and suffered the consequences. We don't know, do we? Because she describes him as handsome, doesn't she? More than once in the film.
Yeah, and, she does, yes. Yeah. When they're having all the women are together having that chit-chat in Osage. One of the few times in the film that the language is subtitled.
Yeah, but the connection is there, isn't it? And they're all the sister. It's a chat amongst the sisters, isn't it? And And the one is saying, why do you like him so? And she's like, well, he's handsome. And whilst he is a handsome bloke, he's not necessarily in this film right here, right now, is he? So...
Oh, but he has got the charm, you know, when they talk in that scene, that one of the first scenes that was released for the viewing when they're in the car, and she says something in Osage, and he said, well, it's obviously Osage for Handsome Devil.
That's right,
And you know, so he's got that charm, and he is trying to charm her all the way, you know.
But going back to what you were saying originally, the romance, it does work, and especially in the later part of the film, it's really impactful, because they clearly love each other, despite what he's actually doing to her and King's involvement to what he's doing to the community as a whole. The love is clear, but it's just fueled by this greed and this desire to own. And I think the most one of the most telling scenes in the entire film is the final confrontation then between Ernest and Molly in the courtroom, when they basically sat across the table with the FBI agents around them, and she says, "Did you do that to me?" And his eyes straight away change and he starts welling, and she doesn't break the line of sight that she has with him at all, because she can see the guilt come into the fore. It's like she's looking into him, into his soul, and seeing the true person that he is for the first time. And because it's not a defined time period set out in this, is it?
No, we
don't really know how long they have actually been married.
From the notes that I've looked in, he arrived in the area in 1918. One of the first scenes we have is of everybody queuing up to try and get some money off their guardians or whatever they were called.
Yeah.
And that didn't start until 1921. So there is a gap. There is a couple of years. But as Clive pointed out, I think that that moment that you just mentioned there, that wouldn't have worked unless we had the time to see the romance and the relationship develop. And if it was a two-hour movie, they would have had to do that in 15, 20 minutes.
100%. Yeah. The whole runtime and like that slow burn of that romance leads up to that last moment when she walks out of that room and it's just you're sitting with Leo and you see emptiness and the first time he realizes what he actually did. Like, yeah. Just hitting him all at once. And then that cut to black. That's as perfect as it gets. That was gorgeous. It was beautiful.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, yeah. But as you were saying, Layton, though, what it does is also, we see the relationship between them, even though, that Ernest is doing to her and the fact that he is involved in these crimes. And that's another thing that the film does, because initially, when you saw some of the crimes happening, some of the robberies, I didn't realise DiCaprio was involved in those, that Ernest was involved, until one time he just pulls a hat. He pulls off a mask and it's him.
When they rob the couple.
Yes, yeah.
Well, he's the one doing all the shouting, isn't he?
Oh.
That's what I recognised his voice.
Ah, okay. Well, that went out of my head, that did. When he took it off, I was thinking, he's and the way they're talking about, the Osage, they're just in Indians, they'll get it back, whatever. They've got the money. Mm. And yet he's caught in a marriage to one. Is that dichotomy that I just haven't, it's a very complex idea, which in the second half of the film, which I said, I mentioned early on, which is I call the plot, all of a sudden De Niro's character, the king, comes in, to the fore, and he starts manipulating Ernest. So let me ask you this question. Do you think Ernest was in love with Molly, or do you think he was there because of what, King was trying to get him to do?
I think it's both. Yeah. I think he's genuinely in love with Molly. And that's what I took from his deposition at the end of the film. Like, you just see his look, and it's like, I believe genuinely that he loved her, but he was so influenced by his uncle, and he was so already foregone lost going down that route. He just was in the middle of all of this.
I agree with what Kyle said. He was so easily influenced by people, by peers, and by King, that despite being encouraged to do what these utterly deplorable things to his own wife at the end of the day, and yet still be involved in these vicious crimes ultimately, and not realize until it was way too late the impact and what recognizing what he'd done, that he did love his wife. It's clear, he's clearly played out in the film, but he was so influenced by his uncle. And the example of trying to think for himself and allowing his friend to steal a car to claim the insurance.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
That's always going to work.
Exactly, right? So I've seen this level in the film in a couple of things that I've read, that it's, he's just playing the stupid guy who is easily influenced and, is the guy gets exploited and all the rest. Well, no, the man made real bad life choices. He was easily influenced, but I can only repeat what I said before. He clearly loved his wife, clearly, but the recognition of what he was actually doing was long gone.
Sorry. One of the great things about the character is this, the complexity of him, the fact that he can have two sides to him. So often in movies, you've got to be presented with somebody with very little complexity. The protagonist is somebody we've got to relate to. Well, we can relate to him in some respects, but in others, we are repelled by him. And I think that's just the genius of the writing.
Yeah, One thing I was going to say, talking, I don't know whether this moves on to the second part of your section, Steve, with regards to the plot. Now, De Niro is a man deeply, King is a man deeply embedded within the Osage community. He's accepted by them. He's been, you know, he's been allowed to set up his cattle farm, his cattle business on them. But he clearly wants the oil part of the county that where he lives, isn't it? And De Niro, I don't know whether you guys have thought this, De Niro is so understated in this film. He does have an outburst, I think, once or twice. But I think he's very similar to Pesci in The Irishman, where it was more quiet conversation. You're like, you do this and I'll do that. You do this, I will do that. And I got me thinking, if somebody else had gone into that role, Pacino more than anybody came to mind. they would have gone grandiose with this role because it's there. Yeah. You could have done it. But I think De Niro, I honestly think De Niro hasn't been this effective in a film other than The Irishman, because the last half hour of The Irishman, he is absolutely sensational in it. Probably because he's playing closer to his age. In this, he just has this quiet scheming, and you can literally see he's not twirling his moustache in a comical way, but he's literally in the background thinking, and you can see the thought process crossing his mind. I can use this to get that, and I think he's absolutely sensational in it.
He seems to go over by trying persuasion rather than later in the film, he's when the stress and the pressure gets to him, he does start to bully.
Yes.
At the beginning, it's all about sitting Ernest down and persuading him. And persuading us as well. That what they're doing is legitimate.
Yeah, the quiet persuasion, isn't it?
Yeah.
I love just the intro of De Niro's character. That first scene between Leo and De Niro. Because you just see how controlled King is right away. Like, the way he just interrogates Leo, he's like, did you wrap it up? You know, what were you doing over there? Like, why is your stomach cut? Like, just the way he just interrogates him, and then he's like, you're going to live your life this way, and you're not going to embarrass us, and you're not going to do anything stupid. Like, he just controls from moment one. And I just really adore the performance, because I think it's De Niro's best work since Jackie Brown, honestly. I love The Irishman, but we've seen him do that type of role before, you know, countless times. With King, it was something like, that I was shocked that he was doing, just taking a chance this far into his career like that. And it was such a slimy, disgusting character. I don't know why, but I've been relating him to, like, the warden in Shawshank. Like, very kind of, like, understated villain where you're like, is he bad at first? Is he not? And then, like, just as the movie unfolds and as you understand what's going on, you're just like, this is, like, one of the most despicable people I've ever seen in a movie. Yeah, he just plays it perfect. He's such a great actor and such a great performance in this film.
Yeah, there's a great moment, which is in the trailer, when he's it's at a party outdoors, and it's daylight, and he's marching through the crowd. And you see in the trailer, he's got a stern face to him. And then as soon as he gets, I think he's going to one of the sisters. I'm not sure who's Anna. I can't remember which one it was. But he goes to the sister, and he starts, his expression changes. He leans over to her. He starts speaking to her in Osage. He's telling her all these nice things, you know, how he's going to help. He's always going to be there. And yet, a few seconds before, the anger and the hatred was just whipped all over his face as he was marching through. Nobody could stop him. Nobody in that crowd could stop him. You know, it was just this duality, this flip between, you know,
he's ultimately a jealous man, isn't he? Because he's jealous of the wealth around him that he feels he should be part of. And
but he wants it all.
Yeah, he's weaselled his way into this community, isn't he? He's even gone as far as learning the language as well, isn't he? Right? And I just find him fascinating to watch when he appears, because the moments of saying to the shop owner, you might want to be in your store at 11 o'clock tonight because I've been told that something's going to happen there. No, I'm setting up to get rid of somebody I want out of the picture, and knowing that somebody's going to protect this store. And ultimately, that person is going to be attacked, arrested, or shot, or what have you. But he's instigating all of this because he's constantly thinking on the go all of the time.
Well, he wants to be the king in charge. He is. That's how he sees himself, the king of the Osage.
Yeah, yeah.
Slowly getting rid of them and replacing himself and with people like-minded.
Do you agree with what I say, though, that his performance is utterly remarkable?
His performance is truly outstanding. I mean, I haven't thought about it, like Kyle just said, about going back as far as Jackie Brown, because I think he's done some wonderful stuff. But, yeah, we do take him for granted sometimes, I think. You know, and yet, you know, going back to the Irishman, that moment when he's on the phone towards the end and he's talking to Jimmy Hoffa's wife, saying, no, he'll turn up, don't worry, and he's the one who's killed her. That's very, very similar to his character here, without the guilt.
Yeah.
He's the one who's done these horrific and despicable things, and yet he's going up to people and saying, don't worry, you'll be okay, I'm sure everything will be fine. So it's like that flip of that character.
Yeah.
The Irishman.
It's interesting you say that, because I these two films and even Silence, they're kind of all sharing similar through lines, and they're much more, I don't know, these films are much more dealing with legacy in a way, and like how you're going to be perceived even after you're here. And it's just interesting to see Scorsese, as he grows older and his characters in his films grow older, how he's dealing with legacy and mortality, because these films feel much more than like a Goodfellas or a Wolf or any of those kind of sub-crime genre films that he's made. These feel much more darker in a way, and much more just blunt and brutal, just because he's facing that mortality in his own life. I don't know. It's just interesting, the different feelings I'm getting from his films now than from even a decade ago.
Yeah, he has said that the reason why he doesn't use the camera flourishes that he used to is because so many people were imitating him. So he's trying to do something else. And I think that also age makes you look at things perhaps from a slower, more just taking the time to look at things, whereas something compared to like Goodfellas or Casino, when everything was just, and even The Age of Innocence, you know, everything is just quick cut, quick, you know, beautiful, the next scene, you know, things like that, you know. Whereas now he's spending the time to listen to the conversations and to live in the moment, I think. I don't know if that's what he's thinking, but that's what it seems to me.
I think the end credits, for want of a better word, or the end sequence, I think there's been a definitive choice made by him reading the last monologue, in that respect to what Kyle was saying about, you know, confronting age, confronting mortality. Because I think that, say, worst case scenario, this is the last film that Martin Scorsese makes. The last dialogue on screen is spoken by him.
Yeah.
I think that's a personal choice made by him. Because and if he has
said that he feels that time is running out. He's still got more stories to tell, but time is running out.
Yeah, and yeah. I think that's a definitive choice on his part. And we'll get to that sequence.
We'll get to that towards the end. I will say one thing about Ernest, though. I think that because of the fact that he loves Molly, and also the fact that he's complicit in the crimes against her, maybe I'm reading this too much, but it's almost as if Scorsese is holding a mirror up to our society and saying we are complicit ourselves. You know, they often say that we vote for the people to rob us. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it's almost as if he's doing that, as if he's saying we are earnest. We may love, you know, our families, we may love our wives, but at the same time, we are doing the things to hurt them, you know, and this is an attack on capitalism.
That's certainly one way of looking at it.
Wow. I was mesmerized by that dissertation. That's amazing. Yeah.
That's not maybe slight, I am going a bit too far with that.
I think that's
interesting.
That's not a slight in any way, shape, or form. That is no.
Yeah, so we're going to the third, I was going to say the third hour, but obviously it's the third and fourth hour, when we finally have the investigation. And that takes quite a long time before it happens, before we see Jesse Plemons' character, Tom White, I think his name is.
Tom White.
It takes a long time for him to become involved. And a lot of it is, the lead up to this, is the Osage people themselves campaigning to try and get some, you know, representation and for somebody to take them seriously. And when they do, for example, they hire a private detective, or they hire somebody to, they pay somebody to go to Washington, things happen which are not exactly the nicest, is it?
No. I was expecting this film to be more violent than it is actually is. Don't get me wrong, the violence is visceral, but I was expecting more violence. And I didn't think, and this is probably the first Scorsese film in a long time that has very little bad language in it as well.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's because of the time that they lived in, didn't they?
Yeah, but, you know, they would have had their slang, wouldn't they? They would have had their vernacular. No, I don't get me wrong, there was one scene in particular that I didn't see coming that I thought, oh, that actually made me recoil. But it's not as violent as his previous films have been of late.
No, a lot of the killings are seen from a distance, aren't they?
Yeah.
Personally, I think on the violence, it's not as like consistent through his film in this film as it is maybe in some other of the Scorsese films. But the violence is just so like visceral and blunt and just like really brutal. And there's no levity to the violence in this film, unlike say The Departed, when Nicholson's like, oh, she fell funny, or, you know, like Pesci in Goodfellas when he's like, oh, I didn't mean to get blood on your floor. Like, there's always kind of like a levity to the violence in a Scorsese film. Not all the time, but most of the time. And in this movie, it's just so like matter of fact and quick. And
yeah.
Irishman does the same thing too, where it's just like, boom, you're dead. Like, there's nothing else to it. And it's not as much, but I think it's just as impactful, or if not more. And when it does happen, it really punches you in the mouth.
Yeah, and it pops up at some odd, well, I'm going to say odd moments. It's moments when you don't expect it. There might be a scene when there's just, you know, they sit down chatting and then it'll cut to somebody walking down and being shot in the head and falling to the floor.
Yeah, I would say there's almost like two jump scares in the movie, at least in my screening. Like, people genuinely were like, whoa, like, kind of were caught off guard, like you just said. And it's really effective because it like just grabs your attention right back.
Yeah, I didn't think of them as jump scares. That's a good way of putting it, though, because in many respects there is a horror aspect to it. And I thought that, you know, we'll talk about the music later, but there's a recurring theme in Robbie Robertson's score which sounded to me just like The Thing.
The throb constantly going through it, wasn't there?
Yeah. So it's almost as if it is, you know, alluding to horror, even if it's not horror itself.
In the scene when like the whole kind of farm is on fire and Leo goes to lay in bed with Molly, they're playing a song by Blind Willie Johnson. It's Dark Was the Night, as cold as, or Dark cold Was the Night, Cold as the Ground. And My Dumb Brain, that's in the intro of The Devil's Rejects, so I was connecting the two. But there's like all just like all these little seeds of horror throughout the film as well, which really kind of just add a nice touch.
I love that music. I love that piece. Yep. You know, I am, you know, as you both would know, I love the blues and going right back. And I think I heard a bit of Charlie Patton in there, and he was, like I say, Blind Willie Johnson. And that piece is just... I don't know how they managed to do it. I'm going to have to look it up because it's so crystal clear as well. And the version I've got, you can hear every scratch on the on the recording. But I would love to have a version like that, which is absolutely crystal clear. It's fantastic.
It's not on the soundtrack. I was disappointed.
I know. It's the soundtrack is just the Robbie Robson, I think, isn't it? And a few others towards the end. Yeah. It's a pity. But so what do guys think of... Well, first of all, we had Jesse Plemons. He doesn't have a big part, but it's his role, which originally would have been the focus of the film.
That was meant to be DiCaprio initially.
Yeah.
Yes, it was.
But it was after DiCaprio read the book and said about, I'd like to play a relative of one of the main protagonists. Because you'd have to forgive me, Steve, but I read the book a couple of years back, and King is mentioned... He is one of the main protagonists mentioned in it, but there's a couple of them, isn't there, if I remember correctly?
I haven't read the book. Like I say, I had it in 2018, so it's been 5 years.
But I think the basis of the initial script that Scorsese and Eric Roth wrote was based from the birth of the FBI then, wasn't it?
Yes.
And the Assange was like the mission of the week. This week's episode is... the Assange and murders, and it was going to be like that. But it was after DiCaprio read it that he said we should switch this to the Assange people themselves, then introduce the FBI. Yeah, Jesse Plemons is second Scorsese film now after The Irishman?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
There's a couple of other cast members as well from previous films as well. Jesse Plemons is, I think, one of the go-to character actors in modern cinema at this moment in time. He's Mr. Dependable.
He is, yeah.
100%. He's great.
Yeah, you know, he's Mr. Right, isn't he? And you just
and
know...
he doesn't have to do much.
No, and I'm trying to think when I first encountered him. I think it might have been Friday Night Lights, the TV show.
I saw him first in Like Mike. He's like 13 in that movie from like 2001. And he's like the antagonist, like bully kid, and he's phenomenal in that. And to see him, I grew up with him, basically. I've grown up like with Jesse Plemons since I was a little kid. And it's so amazing to see him like take this arc through his career. And now he's in Scorsese movies, he's in Breaking Bad. He's phenomenal.
Have you guys seen Game Night?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, the Jason Bateman.
Yeah, he plays the neighbor.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The weirdo, at least.
He is absolutely hysterical in that film. And it just shows, to me, it just shows the range that he's got in all these varied roles that he can do. He's absolutely hysterical in that film. And then yet, when you see him in something like Breaking Bad, where he is ice cold, he is brutal. He's just such a reliable guy. He's tremendous. He's so, so good.
Well, in this now, in Killers of the Flower Moon, he doesn't say a lot, but you can see him, you know, he's obviously in charge of the FBI. And a lot of the time, you can see the machinations working in his head as, you know, he's investigating it. Because not a lot of time is spent on this investigation towards the end. But as you say, he is the go-to character actor because he doesn't have to do much. And yet, he completely owns the characters, whatever character he's playing. But
yeah,
we also had Brendan Fraser, who was in a lot fewer scenes, but chewed the scenery up quite well, didn't he?
And John Lithgow going again.
Yeah,
John Lithgow, yeah.
Out of nowhere.
John Lithgow, I knew Brendan Fraser was in it, but I must have completely forgotten that John Lithgow was in it. Brendan has a good go at the scenery, I'll say.
It's in character, though. You know what I mean? Let's,
oh, it's,
you know,
yeah,
100%. Yeah, yeah. No, we're not criticizing his performance. Right?
No. You know, it's very much in character, isn't it? Because I don't know if you remember the first trailer when it came out. The quote from the children's book, "Look for the wolves in this picture." It was the scene where, like, the town elders, then, shall we say, are sat in the room, and Brendan Fraser is in the one corner. From then, I just thought this is going to be like one of the most impactful scenes in the film. And Brendan Fraser, in that sequence there, when he's trying to persuade Ernest, isn't he? You know, that legally, you know, you can't do this. And then you've got King's wife and daughter pleading. And, you know, they're trying yet again to manipulate Ernest, aren't they, to get onto their side. And Brendan Fraser is really quite commanding in that scene. Whereas in the courtroom, it almost falls into the trope of the classic courts. Your Honour, you know.
Yeah.
I demand this and I demand that. It does work for the film, but he's having a good old go at it. And it is, that's not a criticism, and it isn't a criticism.
No, it's nice to see him and John Lithgow going up against each other as well. That must have been a fun scene to film, having all those together.
Yeah, and John Lithgow has always given me the impression of being like a consummate professional, whatever he's in, to be honest with you.
Yeah, he's fantastic, isn't he? But, you know, and then towards the end of the film then, of course, we have DiCaprio, Ernest, having to make the decision. And throughout, I mean, I don't think he ever actually makes a decision. He's always wherever he's led, I think.
Mm.
And even towards the end, when he's making the right decision, he still, I still didn't get the feeling that it was entirely his decision.
I didn't think of it that way, but you're right. Like, he's just going with what's right in front of him. He's never thinking for himself. He's never considering, like, what would be best for himself. He kind of just follows the path that's given to him always. And that's so perfectly in line with his character, and just shows his downfall at the end of the day. That's a really interesting point, Steve.
Yeah, I agree. And it's quite telling that it's when the final decision is when his wife actually confronts him. And
that's such a powerful scene.
You know, it's so impeccably acted between them. that as a result of him then in the courthouse, the camera doesn't shift from his face, does it? And you've got John Lithgow walking back and forth asking the questions. And do you see the man in the room? And can you point him out to him? And, you know, and DiCaprio's face. And you can see he's lifted a weight, but he's added a further weight because he knows the implications of what is about to happen to him. It's so brilliantly shot. And again, going back to what I said earlier, DiCaprio's face, the measure, what you can measure off his face as what he's saying and what he's done, is utterly remarkable.
Going back a little bit, right, because another scene which really, really stood out for me, and it's in the trailer, but even when I saw in the film, it just sent goose pimples down my back because of the performances, was, remember when they are woken up in the middle of the night because of the explosion, and Ernest goes out to try and find out what happens, and, you know, his face, those jowls, you know, and the explosion and everything, he's involved, and the implications of, like, slowly making their way into his head, and then he goes back to the house, and the family are down in the basement, and you just see his face looking, you know, all he does is, like, shake his head, and Molly just screams on top of her voice when she realizes, again, nothing is said, you mean, all he does is shake his head. He doesn't say, look, your sister's dead, nothing like that. He just shakes his head, and then her reaction to it, I'm like, oh, that sent goose pimples. And that and the final scene, as you said, in the courtroom, those two scenes are just amazing.
Mm. The great way that scene is shot, what you're referring to about the basement, when he gets back to the house, obviously there's a lot of disorientation within the family. And when they're in the basement, you've got the two nannies, or the housekeeper and the nanny with the children, and they're all chatting and upset, and the children are crying. The moment Molly reacts, everybody else goes quiet. Did you note this?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's sort of because the impact is so great that they recognise what's happening to Molly. It's remarkable.
Even though it's in the trailer, you know it's coming. It's a fantastic scene. Let's talk about the photography, because I know that Kyle is very, very eager to pronounce the surname of the cinematographer.
Rodrigo Prieto. I believe I got it. I'm not sure. I apologize. But it's gorgeous. It's incredible. And you know what? To your point earlier, to both of your points earlier about this being a theatrical experience, unlike The Irishman, where that movie felt very digital because of the effects that they were trying to pull off, like, there's a lot of times in the cinematography, it just feels artificial, and it's because of the facial CGI effects they're trying to do, and it's not really anyone's fault, it's just something that I felt subconsciously. And then coming into this film, it was just breathtaking and gorgeous and just so vast. It felt like watching a John Ford or a David Lean film, like, back in the theater in the 1950s. Like, it was definitely hearkening to those old classic epics of yesterday. It's gorgeous. And just the lighting and just the shot composition, just everything is as on point as any Scorsese film has ever been.
Yeah, you get a feeling that this is the film which his film education played a part more than any other, because all these, you know, the vast majority of the films are set in a city, and a lot of them in New York. You know, it's the life that he knew. It's, you know, he's often talked about having asthma and looking at the world pass by, you know, when he was younger and looking at the films. But this is the film, you know, he often talks about one of his favorite films being Duel in the Sun and all these great epics. And I think this is the film that you can see the translation of those images he saw on the screen to him using them in a film himself.
I felt Kurosawa's Ran as well. Like, I felt a lot of, like, kind of influence from that film, just the sheer size and, like, just the scope of it all. And this almost feels like, in a way, Scorsese's Ran in some ways. I don't know. That might be overthinking, but I just felt kind of a connection to that film as well.
Yeah. And that wonderful moment with the fire. When, you know, we've already talked about, you know, dark was the night, cold was the ground, playing over it, and you have the fire. And there's a great line beforehand when some men are standing in the field, and they say, well, is that a fire over there? Is that King's field? And they said, and somebody said, he took an insurance policy out for $30,000 last month. And the other one said, well, you've got some work to do in the morning. but it's so beautiful, that long camera, the long lens, and you see the shimmer of the light, and it's just the silhouettes of the people trying to douse the fire.
And the workers almost look gothic in some of the shots. You know, like, they're almost, like, zombie or, like, almost ghoulish in the way they move. They look like scarecrows sometimes. It's just, like, the distortion of the heat and the flame and the long lens all together. It was so interesting to look at. Oh.
They looked like devils to me when I saw. I was watching. They almost looked like at points as well. They were attacking each other just because of what they were actually doing. This is, and I've seen this described elsewhere, this is technically Scorsese. Well, it is. It's Scorsese's first Western, isn't it? If you think about it.
100%.
And and it's a modern Western.
Neo-Western. Yeah. Now is the time where he can do what he's probably never been able to do in the setting that he's in. I'm not saying, you know, with a film like The Last Temptation of Christ, he couldn't have had sweeping shots. Gangs of New York is very big in its scale, isn't it? Yeah. But this is different. This is much like the runtime. This is spread out. Everything is spread out. There are wide open spaces. There are long pauses. There are long silences. You know, this is Scorsese breathing out through camera. I want to show this. He says with his gesturing arms, but in an audio format.
It's funny what you say about the Western as well, because I'm just thinking now that one of his favorite films is The Searchers.
That to me is the most obvious.
Ernest is very similar to Ethan Edwards.
Mm-hmm.
This family man, this likable man, who's also, you know, this horrible racist, you know, who is judging the young girl because not because something she's done, but because he thinks that she's been tainted because she's, you know, been with Native Americans for too long. It's like Ernest is, or perhaps not Ernest, but King Hale is Ethan Edwards.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that.
I think this is his homage to films like to The Searchers and to I keep on saying Lust in the Dust. It's not Lust in the Dust.
Lust in the Dust.
I think what it was originally sold as. I think it was like a copy line for Duel of the Sun. But then I think there was another film a couple of years later, perhaps in the 60s or 70s, called Lust in the Dust, which had lived up to its title, didn't it?
Lust in the Dust was a mid-1980s comedy spoof western with Divine in it.
Oh, okay.
Wow. Now you're pulling.
Yeah, I'm telling you, this is classic video shop era, Kyle.
I remember the film,
I'm sure it must be in 85, 86. Got to be about that, because it came out on Columbia as well. I can remember it coming out on Columbia.
Oh, okay. Well, that's not the version I was referring to.
Yeah, 84.
There we are then. Yeah. Oh my days.
Right, I'm sure that Duel in the Sun, which was it Gregory Peck and Jennifer Jones? That's just, it was supposed to be in Selznick follow up to the Gone with the Wind. And I'm sure that's what the line they used on the copy line, or, you know, on the posters was Lust in the Dust. So there you go. The Killers of the Flower Moon is not Lust in the Dust.
Far from it.
No, far from it, indeed.
Anyway, let's move on to something you've already mentioned, Leighton, is the end cards. And the way that Scorsese presented them, not in the usual way in which you get a black screen and perhaps you might have a picture of the original person and say so-and-so lived until they were so-and-so and died because of this, or went to prison for so many years. He didn't do that, did he?
No, it's presented as a radio crime show. It would be a podcast now. It's literally set in a theatre with an audience, with actors, with a live orchestra, and with two separate Foley artists. So they're reading off a script going, Ernest Burkhardt was sent to prison, and a literal door slamming on the stage.
Yeah, and the turning on some keys rapping.
And the turning on the keys and the bottle smashing and, you know, whatever. It's, they've got a couple of actors doing different voices, one of whom is Jack White. I don't know if you clocked that.
Oh, no, I didn't know. That's who it was. I thought it was either Evan Peters, but okay, Jack White.
No, it's Jack White. That's hilarious. Jack White. who actually did real good voice, I thought.
Yeah, he was awesome. He was awesome.
Yeah, it's funny that he's a singer and good voices, but the final monologue, and it's almost Marley's obituary, is read out by Scorsese, and he says she divorced Ernest. Ernest went on to go to jail for life, I think he was sentenced, but he got out early. But basically, he gives the monologue as to what happened after people were caught and were convicted.
And his voice almost breaks, doesn't it?
Yes. In the last couple of sentences, he sort of goes that, you know, Molly, she only lived to 50 and she died ultimately of diabetes. She had remarried.
And there was no mention of the murders at her.
No. They say what's on her headstone, wasn't it? It's really quite moving. It was really quite profound as well. And it really stuck with me. And the film as a whole really stuck with me after I watched it. As I said to you two over a text message, that I found the film, it really makes you dwell on it and really makes you think about it and makes you think of people's actions and people's reactions. Whether or not Scorsese, given that final monologue at the end, even given his age, given that, like I said earlier, this could be his last film. Not that I'm saying it is, but if it is, that will be the lasting legacy.
Yeah. And I think that the fact that he says that no mention of the murders were made in her obituary is almost as if they to say, you know, people are trying to forget it. They were being written out of history. Not only that, but in the radio show that they were presenting, they have a white actor to play a Native American role and put on that, you know, the cliched, stereotypical voice. The only thing that was missing for it was him to hold up his hand to say, how?
Yeah.
You know, that's the only thing I was missing for the cliche, you know, and the stereotype. And even at the end, white men were speaking for the Native Americans.
Yeah, that's right.
What do you think of this way of presenting these end cards, Kyle? Because as a filmmaker yourself, I think that the obvious way of the route to go down would be just to have an ordinary card with writing on it, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, I kind of looked at it, you know, I was thinking of like kind of true story films from the last decade, and a few examples that came in my mind were like American Sniper, Patriot's Day, and Black Klansman. They all have kind of similar endings where they present the real facts to you, but it's more slideshow, clippy, and like showing you actual real documentation of the real events. And I find those endings actually cheap. They kind of cheapen the film because you're seeing footage from the actual events, and it's like your emotion is viscerally reacting to the real nature of what you're seeing and not the actual creative filmmaking of the director. And seeing an ending in the way that Scorsese does with this film, which is genuinely creative and also just as impactful as any other way you could present that information. And I thought it was really expertly done. And I know people are going to take Scorsese being in the film the wrong way and probably roll their eyes. Some people might roll their eyes, be like, oh, really? Come on. But Leighton, you are 100% correct. Like, the legacy of what that could mean if this happens to be his last film, it's such a perfect bookend to a 50-year career that's been astonishing.
His voice is actually throughout the film because I think earlier on in the film when somebody's presenting a telegram, he's the one that reads it. And I think he's in it about two or three times, I think.
Okay.
Right. But it's just dawned on me now, the way that he's ended it is the polar opposite to the way he started it, because he actually starts the film like a newsreel, doesn't he, in the cinema?
Yes, it's more real, isn't it? It's more than you would expect.
Yeah, but it kind of ironically, the way that Kyle was saying that, you know, you have the real life events at the end of those films that he was talking about, especially the Black Klansman one. The Black Klansman one made me very, very angry. Like, it should have made me very, very angry with the footage from Charlottesville. And that should make any viewer angry. But he's actually started the film I'm assuming he's recreated the news footage. I don't know whether that was.
I think it's incredible recreations. I was trying to figure out when I was watching. Yeah. And some of it feels really on point.
Yeah, there was one moment and I thought, no, that is a recreation, but it's so well done. It's extraordinary filmmaking. It really is. But, you know, to start the film that way and then to do what he did to the end, it's remarkable.
Well, I was watching it as I was doing a bit of research for this. I was watching one video today and it was actually a Native American reviewing the film. And he said at the end of the film, there was two reactions from the audience that stood out for him, which he said really pissed him off. Right, one was, another, anti-white film. You know, there's too many of these at the moment. Another woke film. Undoubtedly, you know, I mean, if you are completely anti-woke, you're not going to like this film. But the other thing that they said was somebody stood up and said, could you imagine if this was real? It would have been horrific, wouldn't it? And he made me think,
Jesus.
Right? He doesn't actually say, I don't think, in any part of the film, based on true story.
No, I don't think.
But do you think that, people would have, when they're going into the cinema, the posters say it's based on an American story or whatever, I can't remember exactly what it is. The reaction that people are going to have from this film are going to be very, very wide-ranging. Not only because of the length of the film, I know a lot of people, Jamie Hancock has said that he thought there was a 2.5-hour masterpiece in a 3.5-hour film. And, Mark Kermode has said about how he thinks that it's filmed for streaming, but the visuals are for the cinema.
Mm.
And I can understand that. But I suppose to sum everything up now, right, if I ask each of you, what's your final thoughts on this film? And if you can give it a score out of 10.
I came into the film, going to see it a couple days ago. I got out of work early and I was actually outside all day, so I'm dripping wet. I didn't have time to go home. And I was really dreading the runtime, like everyone's talking about. And I gotta say, about 15, 20 minutes in, I was fully engrossed, and I was not let go until the final fade to black to the title. And unlike Irishman, where I did feel like it was a little long in the tooth, and a few of the visuals took me out because of the just artificialness, every frame of this movie feels like there's love, care, and affection too. Not saying Irishman doesn't have that, it just didn't work for me in that way. This film not only earns its runtime because of the subject matter, it earns its runtime because Martin Scorsese is using that as a weapon to hit you emotionally home with its themes and its impact of its characters. It's engrossing, it's entertaining, and it's just a story that needs to be told as brutally honest as possible. And for me, it's a masterpiece, and it's one of the best films of Martin Scorsese's career. And wow. it's a perfect film to me in many ways. Again, I've only seen it once, so I don't try to give things ratings like right away, but to me it was flawless, and it's a masterwork, and it's just an incredible piece of art. 10 out of 10.
Okay, man.
If you've seen any of my social media, it should come as no surprise to anybody that I think this film is a masterpiece. I agree with Kyle. I think this is, in a body of work that contains undoubted all-timers, this is probably going to sit alongside them. This is filmmaking of the highest caliber. The runtime is daunting. I don't know whether cutting a full hour would make it an absolute stone-cold masterpiece, because, as I said earlier, this film needs to be able to breathe, and Scorsese is breathing everything into it. And there's one name we haven't mentioned, guys, and that is Thelma Shoemaker. The editing choices in this film are impeccable, which should come as no surprise to any of us. They are like salt and pepper. They just go together. They work so perfectly in conjunction with each other. I think DiCaprio, I honestly think it could be DiCaprio's best performance. He did something like The Wolf of Wall Street, which he should have had more accolades for than he did. I know he was brilliant in The Revenant, but he's just different in this. Robert De Niro, as we've all said, this is his best that he's been in a very, very long time. Lily Gladstone is the beating heart at the centre of the film. Cliché, perhaps, but she is phenomenal. The cinematography is brilliant. The supporting cast, I don't think we've even talked enough about, because they are truly brilliant. Scorsese's got this brilliant knack of getting people with these interesting features. The most obvious being the guy who plays Blackie Thomas in the film.
Oh, yes, yeah.
He's such a striking looking guy. And the guy, John, the guy who's got a big scar down the side of his face and then 12 children. He again, is one of those faces that just sticks out when Scorsese's framing him. It's remarkable. This film is going, I'm going to watch it again. I'm probably going to watch it again after that. This film, this is a truly, truly modern masterpiece. And I'm going to say 10.
If you had said anything other than 10, then after what you just said, it would have been a bit of a lie, wouldn't it? Yeah, truly modern masterpiece. I'll give it a 7. That wouldn't. I agree with you guys. I think all three of us agree. I've got no when you think about the length of the film before the film, it's an issue. You know, I have to take the day off to watch it because I knew I couldn't fit it in at any other time. But when you're watching it, it doesn't feel like 3.5 hours. You're completely involved. You're completely swept away with it. It's, you know, as you say, it's gorgeous to look at. The editing is fantastic. The performances. I think Lily Gladstone is a shoo-in for the Oscar next year for Best Actress. I wouldn't be surprised if De Niro got his third. You know, he hasn't had one for, was it 40 years now, I think, since Raging Bull. So I think he's, you know, it could well be a legacy one for him as well. I agree with you, Leighton. I think DiCaprio, this is his best performance, or amongst his best performances ever. I think it's just a fantastic performance, I think. And the fact that he can pull off this simpleton who does some terrible things, can be likable and hateable, if that's the right word. At the same time, you know, we can judge him, and we can, you know, it's such a complex character, and he pulls it off wonderfully. I don't think he'll win, because I think that Cillian Murphy's time for Oppenheimer, I think, you know, sometimes it's not how good the performance is. I think it's just the time that it's your time. But I think that, yeah, DiCaprio is fantastic. I think the music, I've been listening to the soundtrack by Robbie Robertson all weekend, and I will continue to listen to it. It's amazing. And the classic songs, the old songs they've got in the film as well. I mean, I encourage anybody to search out Dark Was the Night, Cold Was the Ground by Blind Willie Johnson. It's a haunting piece of music. It's a gorgeous piece of music. And in the scene that it's in, will, anytime I listen to that music in the future, I will be seeing flames in the distance with the shimmering light, you know, the flames coming up and the heat distorting the screen. It's a wonderful film. I too will give it a full film 89, 10 out of 10. So out of the three of us, the average is 10. Nice and easy to work out. So one last question before we go. It's a slight diversion, but Martin Scorsese, greatest living director, yes or no?
One of.
I'll be the one to say yes then, okay?
Well, no, I would join you, because he's the one director that no matter what he's making, I will go out and...
I think he is. I mean, we could all say, you know, is it Denis Villeneuve? Is it Spielberg? Is it Christopher Nolan? Is it Park Chan-wook? Whomever. But yeah. I think a lot of people would probably say, I hate to use the term, but it's Killers of the Flower Moon could be filmmaking 101, isn't it? Because every choice is perfect, practically, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
I honestly think that if you asked any other filmmaker who they thought, they'd probably turn around and say Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, to go off of that, I say one of... But all of them are looking up to him, to Martin. And that's the realist at the end of the day. You can say he's one of, but at the end of the day, everyone's looking up to Martin.
Yeah, he might only be 5 foot and a fart, but he's the giant that people stand on, whose shoulders they stand on, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
But anyway, Kyle, we can people contact you if they want to talk about Killers of the Flower Moon or any of your work that you're doing at the moment.
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm actually going to be hopping back on Twitter soon. I'm preparing my next feature film, which is going to be a Western, incidentally enough. But right now, you can find me Kyle Reardon Film, or it's X now. That's how long I've been gone. Or just Kyle Reardon on Letterboxd, and hit me up there. I'm usually on there more than anything else.
Excellent.
I am on Twitter at LateWinst. I am on Letterboxd as well, but I forget about it. I did remember to put Killers of the Flower Moon on there, though. That's where I am predominantly.
You can contact me on at Twitter or X at Welsh Bluesman, and don't forget to go to at Film89UK on Twitter as well. Yeah, thanks everybody for tonight. It's been fantastic talking to you all about this wonderful film. Yeah, so everybody, thanks for listening. And go out and see this film while you can on the big screen. Out.